On May 2, 2007, Jonathan Porritt spoke in Vancouver, Canada, at a theater in the Round. His topic? A sustainable future. Whose business is it anyway? That 44-minute talk is available from the Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org in the Climate Solutions section. Now we listen to the second part of the question and answer period, where invited experts and citizens began a dialogue on sustainability and world issues with Porritt, who is the head of the British Sustainable Development Commission, a founder of the Green Party movement in the UK, and a former director of Friends of Earth UK. His latest book is Capitalism as If It Mattered.
I wanted to quickly ask Robert Sofrata to comment on whether attempting to run Novex in a sustainable fashion can be reconciled with the pressures that are on him from the marketplace. You're taking on a responsibility that doesn't naturally come from the free market as it's currently conceptualized. Are you able to neutralize this or turn it to your advantage so that you're not at an unfair competitive disadvantage for trying to be sustainable?
Well, thanks. Certainly, if when we started out 4 or 5 years ago in shifting the business from here to there and doing business in that different way, and we have done many, many things very quickly, if we had for one minute thought that we would result in a less profitable company at the end of the day, it would have been in a way folly, because we would be a bad example that anyone else would ever attempt to do this sort of thing. So it's bigger than us. All of this is bigger than us. And in fact, that's been a great motivator. We're not a large company. We're 100, careers in the local market. And we're very proud, and I do show, that our earnings and our top-line sales and our earnings are better than they were before we started. So we have to consider the triple bottom line, and we do.
Thank you very much. Now, let me go by section for a second. Is there anybody in this section that would like to? Okay, there's 1, 2, 3 in a row. Let's hear what you have to say. First row first.
Thank you. I have a few points I'd love to get your thoughts on. First is, you mentioned, you just brought up the issue of birth control, and you mentioned earlier fishing, water stress, biodiversity, accumulation of toxics, and I just have to wonder what proof we have of putting more synthetic hormones into the environment and the impact. Is that a contradiction? Second, what role you think religious institutes can play in community sustainability education? And third, I am curious why you think meat and dairy production and consumption is so rarely mentioned as a serious source of global climate change. And, for instance, there's virtually no mention of an inconvenient truth. So those are my thoughts on it. But thank you very much for being here.
Hello. My name is Lucas Malinowski. I'm an SFU student, and I guess I've been thinking about this throughout the evening, so I might mess up the formulation of my thoughts a bit, but I hope this works out. I guess throughout the evening, we've come up with the point of the economics of being environmentally sustainable and being concerned about the environment. And I know in our current government in Canada, a big argument for why we're not moving more quickly towards mitigating our environmental impact is because of the economics of things. And I know I've heard over the past few years that it can be economically beneficial for companies to have a more environmental mindset, and there is benefit from that. And for me, although I concede that, we have to have business and corporations on board, I have trouble with the argument that, you should be environmentally conscientious because it's to your benefit for your shareholders and your profit line, profit margins at the end of the day. This is a bit of an extreme example, but for me, this is analogous to saying murder is a bad thing because it reduces the labor pool. But if we're overpopulated, then it might be okay because we have unemployment or something like that. It's an extreme example, but that's kind of how I associate it with. And the association I have with, I guess, environmental ignorance, you can call it, or a mindset of externalization, is akin to slavery. Slavery used to be an okay habit in our societies. It used to be a big motivator for our economic systems and progress of human society in general. But at one point we decided it's really morally reprehensible and we probably shouldn't keep it up anymore. And wars were fought over this argument of whether slavery is morally okay or not. So I guess the question I'm asking you, and this is, I guess, a big question, is do you ever see, I guess, the human race getting to a point of where being concerned about the environment and our connectedness to the natural world gets to be really a moral problem on the level of something like, say, slavery, and not just a question of economics and sustaining our way of life and our levels of consumption? Thank you.
Bruce Sampson, I'm with our local utility, BC Hydro. And first of all, I thought it was a great presentation, and it sparked a very interesting dialogue. And I'm interested in your comments about the fact that the markets don't reflect true prices, and your thoughts that that's a role for government. But I'd like to hear about what your thoughts are in terms of the role of the education system in determining how we're going to start to reflect the price of natural capital in the market economy. And I'd also be interested in hearing whether or not you're seeing that happening anywhere in the world, and what were the factors that are helping to bring that about, and how could we start that process here in British Columbia.
Can I just ask, can I come back to you on your point? Your analogy was indeed an extreme one, but can I just test a little bit further? Are you in fact saying that you can't envisage any role at all for a responsible capitalist enterprise in a sustainable economy?
No, I mean, I can mention, I do concede that there is a role for responsible capitalism and corporate entities. But the problem for me is if you base the argument solely on economic terms, you know, there's the propensity for those economic terms of benefit to eventually collapse or fail and not be there anymore. And if your argument is based on economics and the economics just don't make sense anymore, do we no longer care about the environment? And that is my question. I understand that in the intermediary stage there will have to be that, but I'd like to see us get to a different point.
I understand that completely. Well, I mean, I think if I may start with that then, you've certainly put your finger on a really sore point for people like me. I was just testing how sore it was, actually. Because I feel sort of strangely compromised by the work that I'm doing at the moment. And a bit morally vexed by it. Because I spend most of my time speaking with people like you, really, Robert. People with business interests and politicians who can only go so far, and trying to work this business case for sustainable development by emphasizing the convergence of commercial interests and sustainability interests, as it were. And that's the work that we do. And I'm very conscious that part of that work means that you have to find a way of valuing nature differently to make it a more powerful presence in a market-based economy. If nature is valued at zero, wealth creators treat it as being of zero value. Now, the straightforward conventional economic response to that is, fine, well then, value nature properly. Put a proper money value on natural capital and the flows, the yields that you get from natural capital, because then our wealth creators will be able to handle the equation differently. If something is worth something, they'll factor it differently. So just imagine for a moment that every ton of CO2 carried a price of $100 a ton. Okay, just leap forward. I can assure you, within 10 years, that is the very minimum that we will be paying for a ton of CO2. The very minimum. Everywhere in the world. I know that sounds completely zany, and you can obviously now dismiss me as a loony that you may have been tempted to do all evening, but my prediction here is that within 10 years, we will be paying $100 for a ton of CO2. And every enterprise that's responsible for emitting the next ton is paying, having to internalize that cost at $100 a ton. Now, for all you companies, when you're doing your net present valuation calculations, where you're going to put your next investment, if you had to include the cost of carbon at $100 a ton, you would not be making many of the investments you're making today, I can assure you, because they'd look pretty sick and stupid if you had to reflect the true cost of that form of pollution. Now, that's the easy one, because people don't really worry about putting a price on carbon. Well, they might do politically, but economically, we don't feel sort of concerned about carbon. But if you have to put a price on critical natural capital, as in maintenance of areas of special natural significance, where you suddenly begin to think, oh, God, I don't want to protect this amazingly important, beautiful place because it's got a higher money value. I want to protect it because I've got a deep, ethical, empathetic commitment to protecting this, even if it's got no money value on it at all. So the paradox for all of us doing this work around sustainable capitalism is you have to accept some of the tools of market-based economics and move towards increased monetization of natural values to arrive at a more rational decision-making process. Big question for all of us. In doing that and getting good at that, do we actually lose the game completely? Do we corrupt our mindsets? Do we corrupt our spirits so profoundly in getting better at valuing the natural world more realistically that by the time we've succeeded in doing that, the game's over, because we've forgotten that at essence there is a deep moral imperative that we have to respond to, not just a set of rational economic challenges. And I mean, you can tell I feel this one this is quite complicated for me, because I don't really know whether I'm doing the right thing at the moment. I think I am, but I'm not I hope I am, but I'm not absolutely convinced that it is the right way to go. Which comes, if I may, to your question about one of your questions. You sneaked in three, which is a bit tricky, really. But I'll respond to one of them, which was about the importance of religious perspectives and spiritual perspectives on this, because I sort of know in my heart of hearts that we're not going to crack this dilemma through a combination of better economics and wizzo technology. I know deep down the journey we've got to travel is too profound and too long, too distant, to get 9 billion people to a sustainable future in the time frame we've got available to us. Which is why I have always been and am still fascinated by and deeply involved personally in the notion of a more spiritual perspective on this, and a celebration of spiritual insight as a way of accelerating this transformation of the way people think about things. Very interesting you mentioned the visit of the Dalai Lama to BC. I mean, this is a sort of, you know, if you talk to the Dalai Lama about what price do you think is right for a ton of CO2? You know, he'd sort of look at you as if you were really a bit weird and oughtn't to be sort of raising things like that. Because that isn't the way he'd go about it. He'd simply say, you're not thinking about your relationship with life properly. That is to frame the question in the incorrect way. You need to frame the question from the perspective about what is your responsibility as a spiritual entity. What is your responsibility for creation, for the rest of life on Earth? And it doesn't matter what price you put on a ton of CO2. If you can't come up to a deep, spiritually centered answer to that question, you're not likely to find solutions to these problems. So I believe the spiritual side of it is very important. I'm a little bit worried at the moment that actually if you look at the role of religion in the world today, it's hardly a benign one. I'm struck by some of the perverse irrationality that characterizes much of what purports to be Christianity around the world today, particularly in your neighbor to the south, where many schools of Christianity, particularly fundamentalist evangelicals, seem to have adopted a way of thinking about their relationship to and responsibility for the earth that is not just bizarre, but is completely and utterly perverse and so profoundly anti-Christian as to make one wonder how they can have traduced their own spiritual teaching to that extent. I don't understand how they've moved so far away from the obligations of a Christian to act as stewards of God's created world. I just don't understand it. It's just impossible for me to work my way into their mindset to think, how did you get from there, which is transparent and beautifully, eloquently phrased in the Bible about what your responsibilities as a Christian should be, how did you get to there, to this millenarian fundamentalist extremism where the collapse of the physical environment is actually a thing to be welcomed because it'll accelerate the arrival of the second coming of Christ? How do you do that? I mean, what's happening? Of course, we know what's happening in a way. So it's with caution that I advocate deeper spiritual perspectives in these matters, because sometimes that takes you into a very weird world altogether. But without it, I'd really want to know whether how you feel about this. Do you really think that we can make this journey without calling on the deep embedded wisdom that spiritual and religious traditions have made available to us over centuries? If I look at the three key challenges we face, one, thinking about nature in a less reductionist, more reverential way. Thinking about that relationship so that we move from respect to reverence. If I think about the second issue, which is learning to live more simply, so that we don't think our lives are dependent upon increased material consumption. And three, learning to live more compassionately with a view to our relationship with and concern for other people. What sources of authority have given us more insight into those three challenges? Relationship with the natural world, living more elegantly through less, and better balanced relationships with other people, particularly elsewhere in the world. Where, if you look around the world for sources of authority, humanism will get you so far, but you just have to think about the insights from major religious traditions, from spiritual teachers today. Dalai Lama is, for me, a massively important person in my own spiritual development. You can't ignore that. You can't ignore the depth of that insight. And when we begin to mobilize those spiritual insights and teachings in the right kind of way, I can't help but be optimistic about the speed with which people would begin to say, yeah, okay, living sustainably, I get it now. This is just a different way of articulating my faith, my spiritual beliefs, my sort of understanding of what it is that we're called upon to do here on earth for this short dash. Wonderful poem could be interpreted both spiritually and in a secular way, which is very inclusive and quite right, of course. I began to interpret it against my value set and against my sense of my calling here on earth, the sense that I know I'm here to do something. I still haven't quite worked out what it is, but I know sure as hell I've got to get on and do it, because otherwise I will end my dash without feeling that it's been gainfully spent. So I keep coming back to the sense that religion and spiritual tradition is a critical part of this journey, but I haven't really learned how to mediate that properly. Meat. We'll have to leave meat.
Let me look behind me for a second and see if anybody... Here's one. Okay, two. All right, that's from this section. Let's hear those two.
Hi, I'm Janet Moore. I'm with Center for Dialogue, and I guess I'm thinking about, I teach in a program where the director says, and this is going back to education, I guess, we have to think about talking to students about who they are and who they want to become. And I guess this is not a question, it's a comment on the role of the teacher and whether there's balance in the classroom. And I think what we need more of is reflection and time to think about as students and individuals who we are and what we want to become, as opposed to worrying about that tube that you described and balancing perspectives. I think there's so much of that going on, so much information coming at us all the time, that we don't slow down enough and think about what it is we want to do, who we want to become, and how we can move forward with that. So I would really resist, especially because I'm a real supporter of sustainability education, this notion that there's this whole new set of things that we need to teach people. But in fact, we need to unteach and to sit back and reflect on who we are and what we want.
Hi, Mark Roseland from the Center for Sustainable Community Development here. Thinking about some of the earlier discussion about business and K through 12, I'm interested in higher education, which its role here, which I think is closer to business because of that time frame that you talked about at the very beginning. The people who are going to be making decisions soon are the people who are coming out of university very soon. There's several people in this room who are wrestling in higher education, as people are in other sectors, with the role of their institutions around sustainability, people in energy, people in government, people in municipal politics. How do we do this? How do we think about it? And how do we change And when I look at all the good work that we're doing at this university, the reality is that most of the people that we are graduating are going to not be in the sustainability mindset. They're going to be coming out doing the same stuff that they've been doing, you know, 20 years ago, essentially. So even though there's lots of good stuff happening, we're not really making the big dent. Instead of like where recycling was 20 years ago when people were doing it, you know, on their own, but we didn't have the sort of the systems set up. So I'm wondering if you can think of any place institutionally that's doing it right, and if so, how they're doing it.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. And I'm in my sort of madder and more draconian moments, I often do, when I can't think about how to accelerate this process, into my mind pops the notion of compulsory re-education. Because sometimes you think, you do seriously need to go and reframe what it is that you're doing out there as an engineer, an architect, an accountant, a designer, a surveyor, whatever it might be. Because you've taken this framing away with you from the last point of contact with formal education, it's amazingly resilient. And all the new data that impacts on that mindset, this is the very enlightening work of a man called George Lakoff, who has talked about the importance of framing things so that your mind is open to absorbing new information, rather than simply poing, seeing it bounce straight off again, because it doesn't match your basic sort of tenets, your understanding of how something works. So I know compulsory re-education is a bit Cambodian and nobody really wants to go down that line. I would particularly reserve it for economists, I have to admit. And I apologize to the economists here who have to be enlightened by virtue of your presence in this gathering this evening. But economists are an amazingly pernicious breed of people today. I mean, just incredible. And their compulsory re-education, apart from teaching them the laws of thermodynamics, which would be a start, would be compulsory re-education through contact with the natural world. They would not be allowed to be re-educated in places like this. They would have to be re-educated out there in nature, which would teach them what an economy actually looks like, rather than this fictitious thing that we call our economy today. You can tell I'm already getting angry as I think about economists, which is very bad. But you asked me a very practical question, which was, do I know of any examples of things being done differently? And actually, yes, amazingly. We're part of a group in the UK, Forum for the Future is part of a group, which has been working with some of the least glamorous professions on earth. I'm mentioning accountants here, okay, and people like that. Because it's perfectly clear to us that unless one is able to turn that entire skill set that accountants bring to bear on helping manage an economy for good outcomes, unless those accountants are able to factor in, to internalize, intellectually internalize, the sustainability insights that we're taking for granted here tonight, then in a way they can't be expected to do the job they need to do. So engineers, for instance, the Forum's been very involved for 10 years now in working with the Royal Academy of Engineering. Sorry to drop a name, but as you can imagine, if it's royal, it's important, okay? So the Royal Academy of Engineering and all of these different engineering institutes and institutions. We have 23 of them, as you can imagine, because the civil engineers never talk to the electrical engineers, who never talk to the, I don't know, all the other kinds of engineers, okay? They won't talk to each other. We've been working with 16 of these institutions to go right back into basic higher education courses for engineers. What engineers then do in terms of the professional qualifications they continue to gather, I'm not sure what you call it here in Canada, but how they continue to update themselves about engineering. And I have to take my hat off to this bunch, to both the accountants and the engineers in the UK. They've completely changed the basic curriculum, which is now being taught in universities, to accommodate pretty well, not quite there yet, but pretty well, to accommodate sustainability. So in the UK, as of 2 years' time, because it started last year, no engineer will be leaving a UK higher education establishment without having done a whole block of material about engineering for sustainability. Now, I still think that's the wrong way of doing it. I still have to say that the whole of engineering should basically be internalized against sustainability, because you shouldn't really have to add it on as something extra. It ought to be the thing itself. But come on, we're into transitions here, okay? So if we've got that far, that's no bad thing. So I urge you all as activists to think about ways in which we can engage with professions to change the continuous professional development side of it, to change the core teaching materials. It's a very, very important bit of it, even if we don't do the full compulsory re-education side of it. Apologies to economists again. I love you all, really. But
now, we plan to end in about 10 minutes, but we have time perhaps for a couple more. Oh, I didn't do the center, right? There's one, two, three, and we'll try to hit four, and that's probably about all we'll be able to do.
My name is Dr. Livingstone. I'm the executive director of the H.R. McMillan Space Center, which is a public learning organization. And we're changing our focus now from looking up at the night sky to looking back on the most amazing planet of all and talk about how to live on it in a sustainable way. So we're putting the planet back in our planetarium. But along the way, we've always assumed that, and we're dedicated to our youth audience, the young children that come in with the school classes and all of that. But I'm interested in what you said about re-education, but also that there's a growing demographic that is largely marginalized, that has a sense of value, has a sense of spirituality, and has a very great interest in giving back to the community. And I'm talking about a group from sort of age 55 to 85. And I'm wondering whether there's areas, that's a role that a public institution like ours could play in engaging that group and motivating them and encouraging them to action.
Thank you. Excuse me. I'm Judy Piggott. I'm with the Alliance for Arts and Culture and also with the BC Social Economy Roundtable, I think your last comment, Jonathan, actually was, it made me reflect on the quote from Einstein, which is basically that the servants have been valued above the intuitives. And because I work in the arts, you might understand why I think that. But it really does come back to my main point that came up from your earlier comments about the 20-year gap. And that is, I believe, that we see education as instrumental and that somehow we have to keep students in the pipeline as long as possible, and we have to instill the fear of them into them that if they don't make the right choices around education, they won't get a job at the end. And as a result of that, the choices they make about whether to become the servants of the gift or to be able to perhaps inspire themselves to continue with their intuitive side as well has somehow created part of this problem. And the fact that there is no gap, that we somehow feel that our kids, and I have a 21-year-old, so I know what I'm talking about, that we have to instill in them this imperative to go right from high school directly into higher education without any break, without a gap year, without an opportunity to experience something. Not only does that, in some ways, not give people a chance to reflect in many ways on their learning in high school and before, and prepare themselves to make choices for higher education that may be more rational and intuitive at the same time. But I think it also indoctrinates people to look to experts to tell them what to do. And critical thinking has definitely suffered as a result. Rather than downloading and feeling that school-based institutions are required to incorporate values, and how the heck do you do that? Because we can get hung up on that forever in a diverse society such as we have. But rather, critical thinking is the tool that's going to help people navigate through all of this stuff and question where materials come from and who says it, and ask the facilitating question that will raise the dialogue. And we're not doing that. We're creating employees for an industrial model. And, you know, this is just over a week since I had the privilege of hearing another imported, what did you call yourself, practicing subversive from the UK, Dr. Sir Ken Robinson, speak at the Creative Cities Conversation last Monday. And he said essentially the same things about education, which, of course, as someone who works with artists, I can see the danger because they're the canaries in the mine shaft.
just that one. Okay. Thank you. Adrienne Carr, Deputy Leader, Green Party of Canada. I just love this night. I just have to thank you for the people who organized it, Jonathan, for coming and all your comments and questions. I mean, this is, if you talk about critical thinking, I think this is what it's about, being challenged. And I have a confession. You really have woken me up to the fact that I've been spending the last 6-7 years in politics becoming more and more subversive in the form of trying to combat this multiple denial disorder you talk about amongst the other politicians, and framing, moving from a person who worked with the Wilderness Committee and values of and the spirituality of wilderness and nature, to framing arguments more and more effectively in economic terms, because that's what seems to have the impact. So I've become quite an expert in quoting Sir Nicholas Stern and his reports, and your own Prime Minister, who goes on and on about the hundreds of thousands of jobs in emerging green technologies and meeting Kyoto objectives at the same time. And it seems to work. It's sort of bringing people on board. Yet I feel like you, this disquiet in myself, because I'm trained as a geographer and I understand the planetary limits to growth. I get it. So I have this disquiet that all the while I'm arguing and know I'm moving, helping move people in society and politics into a more sustainable realm, yet losing at the same time this notion of why we really ought to be doing it. So I'm wondering, first of all, I'd love to hear from any of you in the audience if it would work to drop the economic line. Certainly, I didn't get elected on the non-economic line yet, so you know, I'd love to get feedback. You're all voters. You know, what would work? I mean, do you? It seems to me like the society that we live in wants politicians to talk the economic line. That's effective. Is it still? I mean, you in this room ought to know you're here. Or should it be the values that you talk about, the spirituality that you talk about, the need to live a life that's more simple, that's more compassionate, that's more in tune with nature? And I want to know what you think it's going to take for the tipping point to happen, to move us not into irreconcilable and out of spiral climate change and disaster, but the tipping point for our world to move to a place where we regain that sense of connection to nature and to each other. And where, when, how, if it's already happening, where is that?
Thank you. My name is Bill Hopwoods. I've recently moved back to Vancouver from living in the UK, and I'd love to discuss with Jonathan about the UK, but I'm not going to. Quite a chunk of your talk was about consuming less, particularly apposite here in one of the most privileged countries in the world. My question is, if the audience tonight were people living in a shanty town in extreme poverty, as in many parts of the world, what would you say to them?
That's a difficult one. Would I be saying anything a great deal differently in essence? Probably not. I would be putting it differently, and I would be saying, please don't be seduced by the incredibly powerful superficial attractions of the consumer-based economic systems that we've developed over the last 150 years, because underneath that seductive appeal, there lies a bedrock of social disaffection, personal dis-ease, a malaise in Western societies that is astonishing. And we've just done a calculation in the UK of what you might call the social costs of living life on this hedonic treadmill, of being caught up in this notion that in order to be happier, you've got to consume more. And it runs to tens of billions of pounds, depending on how you draw the actual figures. The minimum social externality of living the way we live in the UK is around £55 billion a year. And the maximum, depending where you draw the line on different things, is in excess of £100 billion. Now, for very poor people in shanty towns, it's a difficult story to tell that, because they would say, they would look at you and say, they would just be completely disbelieving that any group of people given access to wealth, cornucopian benefits on that kind, how they could be unhappy. It would leave them incredulous, to say the least, and probably full of contempt at the idiocy of building a society which actually made people systematically less happy through the increased wealth that they have access to. So it would be a difficult discussion, but it would probably be based on an understanding that well-being is a different political concept, a different social, cultural concept than material abundance and economic growth. And well-being lies at the heart of all of this. So, I think that we have to acknowledge that most people in the world today, by virtue of access to mass media, mass global media, probably think the smart way of living is living like we live in this amazing city here. And it's going to take a while to correct what I think is a misperception of where progress really lies. So, how can I end this? Okay, well, the first thing about should you go on with the economics? Of course you should. You can't do this without the economics. You know that. It's just impossible. We're working in a world and trying to bring transformation about in a world that has decided to preference economics over practically every other life skill that might make life better for people today. And you can't therefore give up on that and say, oh, that's not right, because it's not the properly balanced way of doing things, I'm not going to do it at all. This is a creative tension in any social activist, in any agent of transformative change in society. You have to live in more than one world at the same time. And yes, as you have done, and I hope I did this evening, you have to surface the moral tensions that that imposes on us as social activists, but not go for a simplified route, a simplified solution to that. Enjoy the ambiguity. Celebrate the creative tension. Don't give up on it. It's part of your job as an educator not to think that there's only one frame of reality, one frame of reference, which will surface solutions to these problems, because there are multiple frames that we have to try and hold in our mind at the same time without losing our integrity. The issue comes down to, once you feel you've lost your integrity as a person in doing that work, stop it. Give it up at that moment. Don't go any further. Because you can only do work of this kind, transformative work of this kind, if your sense of personal groundedness, of integrity, remains intact. If you lose that, then you're not going to be an agent of change in the way that you want to be. So I guess that would be my line of thinking on that, which takes me to the wonderful question about the 55 to 85 age range, as it were, that group in society who are capable of putting so much back into society. And isn't it paradoxical in a way, precisely the point where they're deemed to be less useful to society because they're no longer at the full stretch of their income-generating potential for society as a whole, that that's the point at which they've acquired sufficient knowledge and even wisdom to make the biggest contribution to society at that point. And understanding that richness of contribution from people of that age is hugely important. I mean, 55 to 85 is about right, because as we go on living longer and finding astonishing ways of extending active life now, way beyond retirement, the contribution that people have to make on that score is enormous. And I suspect we will get back to something that indigenous people have known on a timeless basis, that it is the contribution of older people in society that essentially makes society cohesive, that gives continuity between generations, that keeps things bound together which would otherwise fall apart in fractious dissonance. And that is the role that old people play in many, many societies across the world, have always played historically. And because we've discounted old people and the value that old people bring to society and tend not to treat old people as if they had quite the same influence and leverage in society as young people and middle-aged people and the value creators and the social entrepreneurs of a younger age, we haven't done a very good job of it. And I see huge power in this. I'm just watching an experiment being done in the UK at the moment in schools, where older people are being brought increasingly into the schools as mentors, as teaching assistants, as companions to disaffected young people, as people who they share very simple one-to-one learning experiences and all this stuff. And
teachers once would be very hostile to this. They'd say, what is all this unprofessional extra support coming in and possibly threatening our professional elite situations as teachers of the young, which means you've got to have gone through 16 educational experiences and qualifications to be exposed to young people. Fortunately, a lot of teachers today are getting beyond themselves, thank God, in terms of over-pampered egos in that respect. And the presence now of older people coming in as volunteers into schools as part of the community and really buckling down to relationships with young people is just fantastic. And there is no end to the usefulness, the role of people at that age, as you put it. But wouldn't it be just wonderful, I'm finishing, honestly, wouldn't it be just wonderful if all of that sort of experience became available to young people a little bit earlier in life? And I'm very struck by your suggestion that actually all we're doing is putting them through this sausage machine and, you know, out you go, you're properly trained now, go and do that job, earn as much money as you can, and look forward to retirement if it's still available to you at some stage in the future. Seems an odd way to me. Now, I don't know how you address that. I'm starting to get quite extremist in my views about this. And I'm struck by a great unsold success of American society. I think we have to celebrate America's successes these days when essentially we are bound by the excrescences of American culture the world over right now. We need to celebrate the really good things. And one of the most amazing things that America did was the Peace Corps. And because I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, I met a lot of people from America who were doing Peace Corps work around the world. And it sticks with me now because I feel very hostile about America at the moment. I shouldn't generalize, but it's terribly hard not to generalize. I ought to know better. I should not think that America is just a reflection of George Bush and his cronies in the White House. I know I shouldn't be thinking that, but I can't help it. I look at the damage America has done to the world and to so many people, and I've started to turn against America as a force for good in the world, as a force of cultural and economic benign influence in the world. And then I think back to the Peace Corps and this amazing thing. So in the UK now, we're just doing a little test. What would happen if we had compulsory civil service for every single young person when they'd finished their education experience? They weren't allowed to go to university. They weren't allowed to go into a job until they'd done at least a year serving somewhere else in the world to understand more about themselves and more about the world. It would be massively expensive. The Peace Corps was a huge investment on the part of America in taking some of that rich, young, passionate commitment about a better world and enabling it to be useful in a non-imperialistic kind of way. I doubt America could pull that one off these days. Somewhere else in the world. It would take a lot of money. But I'm beginning to think that so many young people today are growing up in such an extraordinarily over-pampered, elitist mindset about the incredible world in which they live and which they can now be powerful and active, that actually they need the corrective of going somewhere else in the world to learn what the world is really like elsewhere. So we're beginning to explore the feasibility of compulsory civil service, not voluntary, where every single young person had to spend a year doing something like that, serving somebody else, somewhere else in the world, to get a better balanced sense of what the world is really all about. Does that sound a bit over the top? It does, doesn't it? It makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. I'm worried that I keep defaulting to these draconian mandated solutions. It says something about my own reading of human nature. But that's the way I'm going at the moment, because I'd like young people to be much more powerful agents of change in society than I see them at the moment.
Shall we express our thanks to Jonathan Porritt? And speaking for Joanna and the other persons who work around the Dialogue Center, we're proud of you for using this great facility in such a magnificent way tonight. I'm sorry we couldn't go on and on. We have to draw a reasonable limit, but this is why this facility is here, provided by the university. I also want to re-recognize Adrian Carr and thank you for coming. I'm sorry I didn't acknowledge you at the beginning of the program. We salute your work in political leadership here in the province, and I think you have plenty of votes in this room. I wanted to mention a couple things to reconnect tonight's discussion to education, since that's my job. And before we adjourn to the lobby and for your private discussions with each other and with Jonathan Porritt, there was a citation in the current issue of Research, Review of Research and Education from a French educator that ran along the lines of saying that it's commonly felt that bad education causes a bad economy, but his thesis is a bad economy causes bad education. And I urge you to contemplate that as you look around to areas where we have a problem in education. It's very evident in BC. There's a bad economy at the root where our schools are having difficulties. This is an example of how some of these arguments can be turned on their head, oftentimes to greater illumination of the issue. Also, I wanted to give a little specificity to Jonathan Porritt's remarks about the pressures we're under in education. For example, the notion that the purpose of education is economic or to prepare economic participants in society, which you were getting at, whereas really very few of us would get into this field for that purpose. We certainly hope our graduates are economically productive, but we get into it more motivated by the desire to see themselves realized. And out of that kind of a person will come an economically productive person, a good citizen, a spiritually fulfilled person, and so on. But to aim only at the economic is to aim too low for an educator. Our purposes transcend that narrow one. We are also under pressure from evaluation systems that insist on ranking and measuring and exclude things right away, like the arts, which you're involved in and which now we know Jonathan was involved in as a teacher of theater. These ranking systems and the notion that everything we do can be measured is one of those pressures, to make more specific what Jonathan was saying. And the voucher attack on public education. Also, Jonathan touched on the notion of education being unable to be neutral or objective, just like journalism, for example. There is no ideologically free education. As soon as you pick a curriculum, you've made choices. And we know that in public education, and so we attempt to be an expression of the best instincts of the community in public education. And the notion that you could just give everyone $5,000 and let the schools be accrued by wherever those vouchers went and let society's values be dissipated in that way, to many of us, is worse than nonsense. And in higher education, we have this enormous pressure, again, that was touched on tonight, toward vocationalization. And as a dean of a professional school, I'm certainly proud of the fact that we prepare people for meaningful professional roles through which they make a living. But I always urge young people to major at the university in what they're passionate about and not to let their undergraduate years be dictated by the notion that they must be concerned overly by making a living at that stage. Or as Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss, and eventually you will certainly find a satisfying and rewarding way to make a living. The withdrawal of public support from higher education is one of the pressures we are under. So we have to look for other ways, including putting more of a burden on the students through tuition. Also fundraising, and sometimes the fundraising has strings attached. But the removal of public support from higher education, which you don't see, for example, in the Scandinavian countries that Jonathan mentioned, is one of those pressures. And then in our province, we have a good bit of deregulation of higher education, which makes it difficult for us to sustain standards when institutions can come in and issue degrees without perhaps any normal standards, credentials for the faculty, facilities, and so on. So I thought I'd take the opportunity as an educator to give some specificity to a point that Jonathan made that I certainly agreed with. We're going to adjourn, as I said, to the lobby. There, copies of this magnificent book will be available, and Jonathan will be signing them. I want to say to you, it's not a beach read. It's a very serious, content-laden book, and it's at least a course worth of knowledge in this book. I seriously commend it to you, and I appreciate Milt Wong bringing it to my attention, because it was through this book and Milt's impressions of it that this event has transpired. And finally, just a word of thanks to Josh Coward, our advancement officer, who planned this event and who, along with Milt, are really the two people that deserve our gratitude for making the entire event possible. So Milt and Josh, thank you very much, and thank you from the Faculty of Education at Simon Fraser University.
You have been listening to part two of a dialogue with famous British ecologist, author, and broadcaster Jonathan Porritt. This question and answer period followed his speech on A Sustainable Future, delivered in Vancouver, Canada, on May 2, 2007, and recorded by Radio EcoShock. Download that speech free from ecoshock.org in the Climate Solutions section.